Today, a Down the Rabbit Hole special in reverse.
Well, hello and welcome to Digital Finance Analytics. And tonight we have a very special guest all the way from the United Kingdom in Bath. And the special guest, yes, it's Martin North. Well, hello, Martin. Welcome to the show, your show.
Hi, George. Yeah, well, it's nice to be on the other end. So I'm the guest on my own show tonight, which is quite interesting.
But that's right. And this one's going down the rabbit hole again.
Yeah, we're definitely going to go down the rabbit hole, and we're going to try and unpick some of the things that are going on. And the reason we're doing it this way around is that, of course, I'm quite often on as the interviewer and host and trying to get ideas and opinions out of the people. But, you know, I've got my own ideas and opinions too, so I thought it would be rather fun to perhaps wave some of those out a little bit more than normal.
Right now, you can see world events, there's the war in Ukraine, there's Israel as well. But mixed in with all of that, there's a lot of financial mess going on. Would you like to tell me about that?
Well, we are in a very set of interesting times. And of course, we have the Trump effect. So Trump has basically said, America first is now the story, and everything else, you know, takes a second place. We have the tariffs, of course, now rocking up, and that really is questioning the world order. There's a question of to what extent the US is a trustworthy ally globally. And more than that, of course, we have the financial system now looking quite wobbly, specifically with falls on the markets, corrections in places. Gold continues to rise. But if you look carefully below the waterline, what we've seen is an accumulation of significant wealth to a small proportion of the global population. But the vast number of people, particularly in Western countries actually, are really struggling. And so there is something I think that we should really question going on here, which is how come that we're getting such a great concentration of wealth amongst the few? How come that more and more people seem to be more and more up against it? And frankly, got to ask a couple of questions. Is the financial system, or indeed the political system, working in the interests of ordinary people or not?
That's a good point. So at the moment, both Australia and UK both have Labor leaders or Labor governments. And it's always been traditional that Labor governments would always support the people at the bottom. What say you?
Well, it is interesting because you would be right. Ideologically speaking, the normal assumption is that the more left-leaning side of politics, call them Labour or whatever, are generally on the side of the worker, whilst the right-hand side, you know, the more conservative end, are in favour of business. However, I believe that it's actually no longer true, and either side or both sides of politics are really on the same side. They are on the side of the corporates, they are on the side of the larger players, and particularly those international financial players and international corporates that really, frankly, rule the roost. And neither side of politics is that different from the other side, so it doesn't really matter whether you bring the left or the right, the liberals or the conservatives back, the Labour or the conservatives back. The truth is that the policies are so similar. Why? Because they are both underpinned by some common assumptions. The first common assumption is that we live in a neoliberal world where we must let the markets rule the roost, firstly. Secondly, we're living in a world where we should be looking for the cheapest sources of everything, so that includes a philosophy about globalization, frankly, offshoring manufacturing, and you know, basically becoming dependent on the international trade flows. And the third is, of course, Australia in particular has been very, very strong in its support for the US over the last 20, 30, 40 years. Both sides of politics have had that very strong view. And so, to an extent, politics in Australia is also coupled with the US, whether that's a good thing or not. So my point is that the original philosophical view that the Labour side of politics was actually in favour of the workers, the right side of politics is in favour of, you know, corporate capital and businesses, is no longer true, which then begs the question, so who is looking after the interests of ordinary people?
Well, I would say the ordinary people. Look, there are outside influences, US, okay. If I say WEF, WHO, World Trade Organization, so WTO, all these very big groups that influence our lives.
Right. Well,
by the way,
but George, the thing about those is they are all quasi non-governmental organizations, right? So they are basically there, if you like, sitting outside the normal political processes. But they are, of course, driven by this same neoliberal philosophy, driven very much, up till now at least, by a very strong connection with the US. You know, the UN, of course, is, you know, US-based. A lot of these other agencies are very strongly aligned. So when you talk about the World Economic Forum or the United Nations, et cetera, there are a series of philosophical assumptions that they are making, which are basically this, that the world order should be united. There should be effectively, you know, one global way of doing things. Guess what? That probably means a digital currency. That probably means, you know, facilitating global trade, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what they're doing is preaching a set of global values which aren't necessarily in the interests, again, of ordinary people. But here's another point. A lot of those entities are quite strongly connected and strongly influence politics and political thinking. So there are a number of politicians in Australia, for example, who have been and are still exposed directly to World Economic Forum thinking and agency. I guess you could also say the same about central banks. So, you know, the central banks that are meant to be controlling the monetary system in each country are also connected by the Bank of International Settlements. So again, these international entities are actually propounding a particular way the world should work. And again, I have to ask the question, is it in the interests of ordinary people?
Well, it doesn't look that way, Martin. And I might add that power is becoming more and more centralised. It was already centralised in each country as a model. You'd have a government, you'd have a bank within the country, and the country would have its own independence. It would actually create its own manufacturing. But neoliberalism has come along with a lot of very powerful people, particularly in the banking sector, and it's becoming more and more centralised. Now, I think that there is, I believe, and I'll let you comment on this one, I believe that Donald Trump will actually turn the US dollar into a digital dollar. He'll try to save it, perhaps, but I think that we're heading towards a one world currency. What are your thoughts?
Well, there are some interesting things going on. Firstly, let's talk about gold. So, of course, gold price is close to 3,000 US at the moment, which is pretty much an all-time high. And in recent times, we've been watching central banks around the world buying gold big, especially in Asian countries. That is probably on the assumption that, firstly, the US dollar, which of course has been the strong dollar of trade and, frankly, the default backstop currency, may not be in the future. So they are looking at alternatives. We've also got, of course, the BRICS group, which is a bigger proportion of global trade than the Western economies, although people don't often believe that. But when you look at it, it's true. And you, of course, have got China and a few other big players in that group. So we're starting to see a fragmentation of the world order that was basically driven by the Western philosophies. And that world order is creating then fragmentation on one side and potentially a shift away from the US dollar. On the other hand, of course, the US wants to keep its position as the dollar backstop and will continue to do whatever it can to make that happen. And certainly there is a discussion potentially about a digital dollar. And interestingly, the central bank digital currency, which the US was thinking about, one of the things that Trump did was to put that on hold when he actually signed a recent order. So that's interesting. But in Europe, they are talking about a central bank digital currency, a digital euro. And later this year, they are expecting to be making some quite big announcements on that. So there's an interesting question there about, you know, the digitalization of currency and which currencies will win out. And the other point, there's some interesting discussion going on in the US about whether, in fact, this is a deliberate set of strategies to take the dollar ultimately back to be more directly connected with gold. And there are gold pundits who are saying, you know, just watch this space. Eventually, we're going to see a recurrence of the gold backing for the dollar. I'm not sure about that personally. I think that might be a bridge too far. But it is worth noting that the value of gold on the US balance sheet, you know, the central, is much lower than the current price. So if they were to revalue their balance sheet based on the current price of gold, then they would have a huge amount of money to play with. So there's some interesting dynamics there. And so as you start to sort of pull this apart, the question is, where is security, where is the source of a value, or what I call the value anchor, you know, because it may not be the US dollar. It may not even be a digital US dollar. It may actually be something quite different, or it may be that we don't have a real value anchor and it's all relative. And I've had the view for some time that we've got this greater relativity going on. Now, the other point about digital, just to highlight this, of course, there is an attractiveness to digital because digital equals control, because you can see more about the transactions that are going on. You can see who sent them and for what purpose, etc., etc. And so there is also a quite compelling set of reasons put out by the globalists and by those quasi-government organizations that this is good because it stops things like money laundering, and it stops fraud and all of those things. So expect a lot of that. But of course, control is really what these players want. So look, my point is this, that there is a whole series of tides there below the waterline shifting in different directions. And I'm not sure that we can be totally clear as to how all of this plays out. But what we can be clear about is that the strong level of inflation, which is still running at the moment and has been running, has fundamentally devalued our currencies. So inflation is not really so much a lifting of prices, as a reduction in the actual value of the money we own. And so when you see house prices rising, it's not that house prices have really gone up, it's the value of the dollar has gone down. And so underneath all of this, we have the devaluation of the dollar in your pocket and the dollar in my pocket, which is why gold is, in some people's eyes, a more attractive proposition. But let me also make another point. On the gold story, if you go back 100 years or so, there was a very interesting development. Firstly, there was quite strong inflation. Then we had a pandemic. Then we had a move to gold. And then we had the stock market crash. Now, all of those things happened in a sort of a sequence that led to the 30s recession, the global depression. Now, I'm not saying we're going to see the same again, but it seems to me that we've got the same components rhyming at the moment, where in fact the real value of money is being reduced, where effectively the assumed order globally is being questioned, where in fact the role of gold looks to be being enhanced, and where there is a tussle between the globalists and the local economists and, you know, the people who believe that the future is one global economy, and others who think, no, we need to stand up for our own economy, you know, US first or whatever you want to say. And there feels to me to be a horrible resonance with what happened a decade, 100 years or so ago. So that's a major concern. And so I don't think digital is as a standalone item on its own, but if you look at it in the context of all the other issues I've spoken about, then it's one we need to watch.
So going back that 100 years or so, 1933, there was a gold confiscation by government. You probably know about that one. And also along came Glass and Steagall and created the Glass-Steagall Act, which lasted 67 years, right up to 1999, when Bill Clinton did an executive order to get rid of it. You're probably aware of that as well.
Well, of course, Glass-Steagall was there to try and separate the speculative aspects of banking from the meat and potatoes aspects of banking. But that's now gone away again. So we've got bankers speculating on all sorts of asset classes, from Bitcoin through to gold and everything in between. So we've actually learned nothing. And what we've actually done is we've pumped up the amount of debt in the system. And if you think about supply demand, the more that debt is being pumped up, that creates more dollars or other currencies. Those currencies then effectively are chasing the same goods and services. That's why we get the inflationary thrust. And that's why I say what's actually happening is that is the value of each dollar being reduced. It's not actually that we're creating more value. What we're doing is effectively spreading the same value over more dollars, and it's actually going down. And I have to tell you that when I talk to you know, ordinary people around the world, people who say, well, my properties have gone up 30% in the last 5 years, I'm doing well. I said, well, okay, hang on a moment, just think about that. If you were to sell your property and buy another one, you'd be no better off than if the prices were half where they are. Sure, if you liquidated your property and then went and bought another asset class, maybe you would be doing better. But it is not as simple as simply saying, well, I must be more affluent now because my price of my property is now, you know, $2 million rather than $1 million. It is much, much more complicated than that. And that's why I come back to this question of who are the winners and who are the losers. Ordinary people are leveraged up to the gills to try and get into property, which is now overpriced because of the way that the monetary system has worked, because of the way that the lending system has worked, and because of policies around the world. And that's the problem. Now, how do you survive in this environment? Well, you've got to continue to pay your bills. You've got to continue to pay your mortgage. You've got to continue to pay your taxes. So we are actually prisoners of this global system that has been running for some time. Now, the question, of course, then is, is it possible to escape the system? Well, it sort of is at the margin, but no, not if you actually want to continue to, you know, live in a particular country with an ID and passports and money and those sorts of things. And so you're caught in the system. And I come back to the film called The Matrix. And The Matrix, of course, is quite interesting because there you've got the blue pill and the red pill. And, do you want to know what's going on or do you not want to go what's going on? And my belief is that it's time for us to recognize what is really going on, which is that the system is rigged. Its system is rigged in the favor of the wealthy. It's rigged in the sense that they always will come out on top, but ordinary people are being cannon fodder in the process. And yet, if I listen to the mainstream media, I don't get any of that. And I'm a bit concerned that actually some of these very important issues are really not being spoken about in the way that they should be.
I think you've wrapped that up really well, Martin. I would say the last 5 years since COVID started to now, I've been horrified by sitting back, having worked in mainstream media, to watch how it behaved and how it... Everything that was coming out, if you look around the world, the same message was being repeated, a country after country. And this is where we get into the conspiracies. But you're actually saying a lot of the things that I've known for some time. I can see where they want to go. They definitely want to go to a digital currency. And then because there's less and less jobs being created because automation is becoming very sophisticated now and there's more of it, there'll be less jobs to go around. Now, our democratic systems now become more and more dependent on government and banking. And we have what I see, a universal basic income heading our way through a digital currency, and of course followed with a social credit score like they have in China. Is that what you see,
Mark? Well, I'm not sure whether... I actually have come to the view that what people have been talking about in China is probably over-egged. You know, there are some important controls they have there, but it's not as severe as some would say. But what I would say is this. There was a recent survey done in Australia asking about whether people wanted the governments to basically, you know, bail them out some more. And what I'm finding interesting is they do. So if you talk to ordinary Australians on both sides of politics, they are expecting the government to solve the problem for them. They are, you know, people know that things aren't going very well and the economy is not performing very well and that they're personally not feeling very good about it. But they have an expectation that the government is going to solve the problem or the central bank is going to solve the problem. And my point is, I am of the view that the government and indeed the central bank are part of the problem rather than part of the solution. So I don't think that we should hold our breath and hope and expect that politicians are going to change their tune and suddenly are going to be looking after the interests of ordinary people. No, they're not. They're going to be actually aligned to the corporates, aligned to these global agendas, aligned to these other global messages that are coming down from those organizations, the neoliberal organizations we touched on. So the question is, if you are an ordinary household, an ordinary individual, what do you do? Because you've got to play the game. You know, you need somewhere to live. You've either got to pay rent or you've got to get a mortgage or whatever. You know, you've got to go out to work. You've got to pay your taxes. And is it too much to say that really we're a little bit on the rat run, where effectively we are, you know, running faster and harder just to stand still? And we're effectively running harder just to keep the current system going. And yet the current system is actually not benefiting us particularly. It's benefiting, you know, other people, not many, but some. And how much longer can this go on for? And at what point do people start falling off the perch?
That's a good point. A couple of things I'd touch on. For the last 5 years, there's been a lot of building work and development along the railway line here in Melbourne. You're probably seeing something similar to that in London. More and more surveillance cameras are about. More high-rise buildings that are being built in the city. I don't know if that's happening in London. I imagine it is, because I see a correlation. And when these people become so broke, they can't keep up, you know, the hamster on the wheel, well, the government probably will help them, and they'll probably suggest that they go and live in our digital smart cities. What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, the old 50-minute city lark and all of those things. It's interesting that here in the UK, they have instigated non-pollution zones, and it means that you've actually got to spend a lot more time driving around, less direct routes, because you can no longer go the direct routes. And in fact, in some places, you actually are charged if you go into some areas at some times of day. So there are various control mechanisms in place. My own belief is that this whole climate story and, you know, keeping emissions down, there is an important kernel of truth in it, but it's also being used as a mechanism for greater control and less individual flexibility. So, I mean, it's part of this whole question of, well, so who is in control? And I guess you could say one of two things. You can say, well, this is just a cock-up theory of history, that effectively, you know, this is just people doing their best and it's complicated and difficult, etc., etc. Or you might actually come to the conclusion that there are a set of assumptions, and a set of assumptions which benefit certain types of players that actually are calling the shots. And those people who are calling the shots may not be elected representatives. I don't think politicians look after our interests very well, as I saw recently in Senate estimates, when in fact, you know, people were asking some quite hard questions of the Treasury and other players, and the Treasury and other players are out of date and out of time and really are not that connected to the pressures on of ordinary people. So we have a real big structural question here, and it comes very sharply to the point, George, because of course we have an election in Australia coming up in May, and you know, the question of course is which side of politics will get back in under the two-party preferred system. One of those two parties will to an extent lead, even if they have to lead with others. The political system is built in a way that means that it protects the existing process, the existing system, and the existing ideas that are there. And like I said at the top of the show, both sides of politics have precisely the same view. So it doesn't make much difference, really, which side you vote, which way you vote, because effectively you're going to get basically the same stuff. So the reason I want to sort of, and I've spent some time on this today, is because I think it's important that people stand back and think about this. I'm a philosopher by training, and so I always want to know the why, what's going on, why is it going on? And I think the first step is to highlight the questions to ask. And those questions are, who are calling the shots? What are the agendas that are really in line at the moment? Not what they say, but what they do. And who are the winners and who are the losers? And, you know, to be honest, have we been made better or worse off by the policies of both sides of governments over the last 20 to 30 years? You could ask in Australia, and you can ask other places too. And, you know, in the light of what has been happening and in the light of what's happening in the moment, What is the outlook? And, you know, to be honest, the outlook is not great unless we begin to change some of the fundamentals and ask some different questions. And that, in a sense, is what this show has been about, George, which is to try and put on the table some of those uncomfortable questions that we should be asking of ourselves and each other and of our leaders too.
Well, I'll tell you what, I should probably throw a bit of a down the rabbit hole conspiracy in here just to kind of pep it up a little bit. The big loser, when you talk about losers, and it's happening in Australia, we've got hate speech laws, which means it's taking away our rights to speak. Now, the big loser in the end is a thing called freedom. You cannot be a free person if you're so indebted and so enslaved that all you can do is just go to work, find another job, find one way or another to try and pay a rent or to try and pay those bills that are ever increasing. Along comes climate change, and it's been pushed on us through the mainstream media over and over again. What I see, let's get to the point here, where we're going is centralised power, centralised money, and even centralised religion. That's where I see us going. Would you like to comment?
Well, I am, you know, not as clear-eyed as you are with regard to who's calling the shots. And like I say, I'm not clear as to whether it's a cock-up theory of history or whether it's a conspiracy theory of history. But what I can talk about is the individual outcomes for ordinary people are not going the right way. You know, I see it in my mortgage stress. I see it in other research that's done as well. And there's a level of frustration with the way that things are currently running. And yet the politicians seem insulated and isolated. They don't seem very switched on to the real interests of ordinary people. There is another agenda then running. And that other agenda, as I've described, is perhaps to do with the neoliberal view and with the you know, connections to the corporates, who seem to have significant control over what happens. I guess the bottom line, ultimately, is that if we don't change things, then this is going to continue along the same road. And you know, we are going to see more and more of the same old, same old. House prices will continue to go even higher relative to incomes. More and more people will not end up owning a property. More and more people will be working multiple jobs just to get by. Inflation will continue to rage. And all of those things are going to be the normal tenets of the way that society works, unless we start asking a different set of questions and begin to chart a different path. And that is what I think we should be thinking about, because I do believe that there are alternatives that could be thought about and could take us to a very different place. And the starting point of that is to turn the idea of politics on its head. It's not that we have a few people top down, whether it's from the World Economic Forum or from the UN down to the political system, and then we're at the bottom. We should be turning it around and saying, no, we are the people. We actually have a voice. And actually, we need to lead rather than follow. Now, that, of course, is a very uncomfortable piece of philosophical thinking, but I believe it's really important. Turn it on its head, and you make politicians effectively look after our interests rather than we trying to look after their interests. So there is a very important you know, political point here. Anyway, George, I reckon we're probably at the end of the show. Thank you very much for running it and allowing me to vent a little bit on what I think are some really important points. And I reckon we might do another rabbit hole in the not too distant future.
Well, farewell, Martin. Keep well.
Take care. Bye-bye.